Welcome to the Modern Woodworkers Association, a podcast about woodworking from folk who woodwork. Woodworking is what we do, who we are, and what we like to talk about. So join us as we have a drink, sit around, and talk woodworking.
Hi, and welcome to the 265th episode of the Modern Woodworkers Association podcast. I'm Kyle Barton of K. Barton Tools, and I'm here with my co-host Sean Wisniewski of the Corner Workshop. Tonight, we're visiting with accomplished woodworker, chairmaker, plane maker, tool maker, instructor, Danish modern furniture expert, and all-around great guy, Caleb James. And I'm sure I forgot something, but welcome to the show, Caleb.
Hey, guys. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Yeah. I was going through your intro, and I was just like, okay, so maybe it'd be easier to say in woodworking what you haven't done.
Yeah, I'm an explorer, Caleb James the Explorer. I just like exploring anything woodworking, I guess.
There you go. Yeah. All right. Well, before we get into talking more with you, I wanted to mention a couple of woodworking news that I saw out there. So of all things, I saw this, and don't ask me why, but I just happened to scroll over to Popular Mechanics website. I don't normally go there, but they had a new... They had an article there on a new method to bend wood. So, and it was kind of interesting. And they're basically bending wood, I guess, more for architectural type things. It's more of a general bend. But the way they are doing it is instead of doing steam bending or laminating or anything of that nature, is they're using computers to predict how wood will warp. So basically, they're taking two pieces of wood and gluing them together where they're cross-grained, so kind of like plywood. And then they use a computer based on the thickness of the layers, the moisture content of when that wood dries, how it's going to actually bend. And they can get pretty exacting things. And in fact, they built a tower using nothing but this bent wood. And this thing's got to be, probably a good 50, 75 feet tall, but it's made completely out of bent wood, but it's pretty cool. So, that was at poplarmechanics.com. The name of the article was "Cool New Method, Curves Wood Without Machines." So cool new method curves wood without machines. Easy for me to say.
Right. That's kind of crazy. I mean, as Popular Mechanics would, they take it to a very scientific.
Yeah.
And, you know, and as a piece of damp wood dries, it contracts perpendicular to the grain, meaning that it forms at approximately a 90-degree angle to the grain. Negative in most situations, but leads wood to warping, but the scientists were able to figure out how to make the warping process work for them. That's crazy.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, it's the Germans that are doing this, so.
Of course.
Well, you know, it sounds like an old technology to me. Sounds like the wet dry mortise and tenon joints, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. You're taking advantage of the wood's movement when it loses moisture. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Old is new again.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It sounded that way to me a little bit too. They're just able to use, the computers to predict exactly how that's going to warp and use it to their advantage. But so that's out there. Like I said, it's probably not anything we'd use woodworking. Looks like this has more architectural like applications, but it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, food for thought.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's an artistic thing there too. I mean, just if you would think to like let a veneer just curl, but use its curl as a form, mm-hmm. you know, maybe you get something.
Exactly.
Way out of my wheelhouse, but.
Yeah.
Yeah. Makes you wonder what their adhesives are, because usually, you know, getting something that's not fully dry to have mm-hmm. an adhesive work with it. So that's kind of. Mm-hmm. I would try it. It would just pop apart, you know.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Maybe something like the polyurethane adhesives or something that require moisture. Who knows?
Maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, well, next up, and we'll get into this a little bit further, but Caleb James is developing a new type of travisher. So,
I'm trying my best. Try and reinvent the wheel, you know.
Yeah, well, we'll nail you down on that because I saw some of the photos on it. Looks pretty interesting.
Yeah, thanks.
So Sean, what's in the shop?
Nothing. I'll take my time to wish my lovely wife a happy 14th anniversary.
Oh.
Yesterday was our anniversary. And I did I told her personally that yesterday, but now all you know.
Yeah.
How about you, Kyle? What are you working on?
I'm working on new prototypes. So I was finally able to get my first batch of orders out for my Windsor stretcher drilling jig. So those are
what were the numbers on those? Did you put out dozens?
No. Okay. Almost a dozen.
Okay. Okay. Almost a dozen. It's a good start.
11. But it wasn't bad. So I got those out in people's hands, and in fact, one of my customers has already built a stool using it and had good remarks. So that's great.
Wow.
And so I think once it gets out there, that's where I'll pick up some new orders. But I've been working on new prototypes. So I got a prototype I mentioned before for drilling or boring holes in seats. So I'm working on a pre-production prototype for that. Should have that done hopefully by tomorrow. We'll see. And then I'm also working on a couple other ones. So those are top secret for right now.
Okay, but I was gonna ask what do you mean by other ones? But okay. Yeah. I'm thinking of all the ways that you can control angled drilling at this point. What other applications are there for that?
There's a couple of more that I have brewing. So, but like I said, I don't know if they're ever going to come to fruition. So, don't want to put something out there I'm not going to fully develop. But I know the one for boring holes in seats, that definitely will come to fruition. So I'm going to have the pre-production unit done, like I said, this week. And then I'm going to get it out to a couple of chair makers for them to test it and get some feedback on. So, and hopefully it'll be like my stretcher jig and kind of revolutionize how you do that. It basically, again, utilizes the rod end bearing to help lock your drill in, and you don't need mirrors. You don't need anything like that to control it. Once you set it up for one leg, easy to set it up for the next leg and so forth. So, and then of course you can also use it to drill your spindle holes and back posts and arm posts if you have those. So looking forward to that. And
I'm excited to see it go. That's
me too.
And Caleb, have you seen what Kyle's producing?
No, actually, I haven't. I was trying to just pull it up on my my iPad as you guys were chatting about it, but I wasn't stumbling upon it just now. But I'm always curious about the different methods people are using for chair making. Obviously, that's always sort of my start when I think about tools. It seems like anymore. So yeah, kind of fascinated with it.
Go to Barton.Kyle on Instagram and you'll see some pictures there. I have some videos on IGTV. But basically what I've done for the stretchers, it's basically a wooden piece that basically replaces one of the legs. So it goes into the leg mortise, the reamed leg mortise, and then it has a rod end bearing on it where you can put your drill bit, you can put a shaft through and you can just aim it right at the other leg. So, you know, the technique that the direct drill technique where you kind of twist the leg just a little bit and use a leg to kind of brace it before you drill into that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's kind of a more foolproof way of doing that.
Gotcha. Okay. I'm seeing some of the, right there. Well, hey, you know, in some ways it's almost like, you got your drill press, you know, but, mm-hmm. You have something that can hold your angle, but you can move it to the item instead of taking your item to it. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. Why not?
Yeah. And I kind of hit on that Curtis Buchanan. One of his videos, he brought out a little jig for drilling the mortise in a back post for the post to go into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he kind of brought that out and showed it. And I like looked at it and I went, huh, bet you could use that for legs. And then I got on the internet and found out about a rod end bearing and went, you could use that with your drill rod extension, but yeah. You know, and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it just kind of all fell into place.
Yeah. You know, I think sometimes the designs that you don't even see coming sometimes end up being the ones that are just simple and really work. You know, whereas some that I feel like I work on a lot, they might come off the shelf once or twice a year over a few years, but you can't really, you never get there, or maybe you eventually do. And then you have another one that comes together maybe in just a month or a few weeks. So, yeah, it's funny how that is.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. So based on that, yeah, it's kept me up thinking other ways I can do this. So that's when I came up with, okay, I can drill, you know, mortises and legs for stretchers. Now, what else can I do? What can I do to make other things easier? And then I went, well, you can actually use the same setup except tilt it on its side for drilling leg holes and stretchers and stuff like that. So in the seat. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that direct drilling method, I think the first time I saw that was in Drew Langsner's Country
right.
Workshops
mm-hmm.
Book, which I don't know. I think he did that in the 80s
I think
something, you know. Yeah. Yeah, that's, you know, and I never used the mirror method or any of that, even though I learned some of that from Pete and Curtis mm-hmm. and those guys. But I always use that direct drilling method. I couldn't figure out why you wouldn't. You know, my biggest fear was always, I'm going to take this leg out and I'm going to drill it in the wrong direction.
Exactly. Yeah.
Why not? Right here, I can't mess it up, you know, unless I'm a total moron. And if I'm that bad, then maybe I shouldn't be making these things. So yeah, I like it.
Well, the first time I tried the second time I tried the direct drill method, maybe I was a moron, but I was doing a box stretcher, and it ended up being a little bit of a parallelogram by the time.
Well, that's pretty tough doing the box stretcher. Yeah.
You know, it's like, there's got to be an easier way to do this. And that's when I started thinking about it. And then when I saw Curtis, I went, that's it. Bing.
Yeah.
But, so anyway, so that's what I've been working on, some new prototypes. So, Caleb, what have you been working on in your shop?
Oh, man. Seems like the last couple of years, people just can't get enough of the spoke shaves. So every time I turn around, I'm messing with the spoke shaves again. But The last one that I developed was I guess my version of a cigar shave or what I felt was kind of this niche where people were often looking for a specific shave that could get into nice tight curves, but wasn't limited to one set curve,
right.
You know. And so honestly, man, I've been messing with this design on and off for a couple of years. And, you know, I had a pile of different shaves and I was trying stuff from really my shave ended up kind of settling on a blade position that I guess you might say was more like a Japanese spoke shave because it's beveled mm-hmm. down. But I didn't want something that was just straight round like the cigar shave, because when you have round handles, you really can't get a sense of the orientation of the tool every time you pick it up. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to get something that was more like a standard shave that had like clear references, so you always kind of know where the cutting edge is. And finally seemed to hit the nice spot that felt good to me, sending out some chair makers and got some good feedback on it. And so that's what I've been making. And I'm right in the middle of another big production. So probably when I'm done with these, I probably won't see this tool for maybe another year or so making it again. It seems like that's how it goes for me. And maybe when a year and a half comes down the road, I might be making something totally different. So, but I'd love to return to it. It's one that's been pretty satisfying to make.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad I ordered mine when I did.
Yeah. Well, you know, I try not to do the, you know, what do they call it? The fear tactic sales. I get them now or you won't get them. But honestly, that's what ends up happening at times. I have all the best of intentions of filling all the needs that people want, but usually I just get caught up in a new design and I can't make myself go back to the old one. And sometimes I do, and then sometimes I don't for quite a while. But yeah.
Yeah. Well, so you've been making those. So that's all right. So are you also making the standard shave with that run, or are you just doing the round shaves?
Just doing the round shave. Okay. You know, really, out of a lot of the tools that I've made in the past, some have been just, you know, straight reproductions. Mm-hmm. And then others have been more my own design, or they feel like they have a lot more of my design elements in them, taking a traditional tool and maybe a direction that's more, you know, based in something that I've added to it. So I have a those are a little bit closer to my heart, I guess. So the traditional shave, and then this round shave, and then even the monster shave that I made, the very large, you know, spoke shave. I probably will keep those guys, I bet, in my tool production to some degree or another going forward. So, you know, I like the chair tools. That's where I started out really in woodworking, or that's where I found my passion anyway.
Right.
And so, yeah, I really enjoy making a chair tool that people can't find somewhere else, and it helps them to make those objects that I enjoy making. But honestly, anymore, that's probably my biggest motivation is putting a tool into somebody's hands that, it fits an application that they, that they're trying to fill. But and they can't find it somewhere else, and it's something that whenever they use it, they go like, oh man, that's exactly what I wanted. I enjoy using that in the shop. I probably don't. If there's probably nothing better than somebody shooting me an email that I can read the excitement in their voice, you know, about the tool they got, and that's probably why I keep coming back to tools, and that's probably why I haven't taken furniture commissions over the years. I just take less and less of those, and more and more tools, you know.
Yeah, well, I have to say I love mine. I have both your standard shave and the round shave, and they are truly fantastic. They're lovely to use. I mean, it's almost intuitive when you pick them up and start using them for the first time. I mean, there's practically no learning curve for me.
That's cool. Yeah. I do find most people do have a bit of a learning curve, but once they kind of learn to sort of just let go and realize it's not your typical shave that has a you know dead flat sole like a plane, and it kind of clicks, and it might be the second or third time they walk out to the shop to pick up the tool, but usually when they get that point, all of a sudden they go, oh, now I understand what this is about, and they realize it's something different. It's a different skill set they can pull from the toolbox now when they need it. Yeah.
And you may be right. I mean, I've been using a similar wooden shave, but yours is definitely a step up in both quality and performance from what I was using. And it was just an antique wooden shave.
Yeah. Well, you know, those guys. Who knows what kind of condition they even came out straight from the factory. You know, it's amazing when you look at the old catalogs. I mean, I can't remember what year it was, but I think I saw a catalog from like 1880 or something. And a spoke shave you get for like $1.50. You know, obviously that was worth more than it is now. But even so, you know, they were making these things by the thousands, and they were almost disposable. You know, you find one of the old ones and the soles are just totally destroyed. And you don't even know what the sole probably looked like from the factory. They just used that thing, I think, until the blade, you know, was dull.
Right.
Went and got a new one or something, you know. Yeah.
The one I was using had definitely been resold at least once. So.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, so it was it. But like I said, your shaves are fantastic. So what kind of led you into this type of tool? So you mainly, you know, you got interested in, well, let's step way back, because I know a lot of that probably has to do with your interest in chairs. So how did you first become interested in, you know, building chairs?
Well, my story is probably, you know, so well worn by a lot of other furniture makers. You know, you buy your first home, you start looking around at furniture, and you start thinking, well, I could make that. My dad was a woodworker. He never made furniture, but he was a home builder. So I think I just thought, well, I'll just get a table saw and start making things. And, you know, I think there was something that was there, an interest in that. And, you know, early days of internet where you could start finding a variety of things like that. And I just started stumbling upon different pieces of furniture, and you start realizing like, oh, there's a style to furniture, you know, and then the next thing you realize, like, oh, there's different eras of furniture styles, and you know, so I somehow stumbled upon Windsor chairs, at some point there, and I always thought, well, it's not exactly my aesthetic taste, but wow, there's something really interesting about how these chairs are made. And then, you know, and I don't even remember who the makers were, but, you know, you were finding some and you could tell these were not your chunky, oversized, factory-produced chairs.
Yeah.
They were more refined. And, you know, that sort of stuck in my head. There was an interest there. And somewhere along the way, around the same time, I started stumbling upon – I was living in Houston. Well, Katy, Texas there. And going to Houston, there was a store that sold furniture that had some Danish furniture in it. Some of the Danish furniture designs were by Hans Wegner.
I know the store you're talking about.
Yeah, was it? Oh man.
Danish Modern, I think, was the name of the store.
No.
Or were you talking about a different one?
It was a different one. This would have been, you know, maybe around 2000, 2001. It had a name. I think it was a family name. They also had some like antique furniture, like, and I'm talking like Italian antique furniture stuff. Well, I wish I could remember the name of it.
So was it basically an antique type place?
It sort of was. Actually, if you're familiar with it, because I know you're there in Galveston.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you go to where the Whole Foods is off of 59 and Kirby area.
I know who you're talking about. Yeah, because they have a bunch of – yeah.
Yeah, it's like houses. Like you walk through multiple houses. They own all the houses and they're filled with furniture. Starts with like a K or a C. I can't remember it.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah, they have a couple of different retail outlets now, but the main one was kind of in that area in a basically a residential neighborhood type thing.
Yeah. They had a storefront that like faced toward Whole Foods is probably boring for all the listeners. But you know, if you left they must have bought a couple of houses
near it.
And set up furniture through it. So it was such an interesting kind of place. And I think that's where I first saw some wishbone chairs by Hans Wegner. And I knew what it was. They actually had a modern table from Germany made by a company called E15. I don't even know if they're around anymore. I remember looking them up online, and they had Hans Wegner chairs next to the table. In the, you know, on their website. And I thought, why in the world did they pick those ugly chairs to go with that? It was so sort of foreign to my eye that I initially felt like, well, that's kind of an ugly looking chair. And then but the more I looked at it, I thought, well, there's something kind of interesting about it though. And I stumbled upon it a few more times and started thinking, who is this guy? Looking at more of his stuff. And the more I realized it, wow, I really like this. I had these two different spectrums of, you know, over the, you know, this old world Windsor and then the Danish modern stuff. I probably say as far as like furniture goes, that's where my interest developed, and particularly with the chairs. At that point, I probably had no thought of ever making a chair or even like I could make one. As I was making some furniture around the house and so forth, at some point, I decided, you know, I'd like to make a chair. I don't know if you want to hear the whole story, but
sure. Yeah. So tell us about your first chair.
What happened was, believe it or not, a lady that I worked with said, hey, there's a woodworking event around the corner here. I thought, I know you're getting into woodworking. Why don't you go check it out? I thought, well, I don't have anything to do. So I showed up over there. And I ran into a class with Roland Johnson over there. He used to write the articles for Fine Woodworking. I think he still does on occasion.
Yeah.
And he was showing us how to sharpen a card scraper and things like that. And I'm telling him, hey, I'm really interested in chairs. And he goes, oh, you need to talk to I said, but I can't find the tools. This is what it was. I'm trying to get travishers and stuff to hollow. See, he says, you need to contact Alia Bazzari. He makes some tools. So that was kind of my introduction into being able to step into chair making. And he says, oh, you need to take a class with Curtis Buchanan. And he's given me Curtis's number and everything. And he says, by the way, I'm going to take a class with Curtis. You know, he's a great guy. It'll take you forever to get a class with him. he was right. Right.
Yeah.
But I went home, put some tools on order with Alia, you know, and I think I had to wait like 8 or 9 months to get those tools. you know, they were so inexpensive, really, you know, so you couldn't hardly, you know, it's not like you call the guy up and say, hurry up and get on that. You know, he was, you know, this guy was working really inexpensive at the time. And, yeah, you know, I ended up getting a draw knife from Country Workshops. I didn't have a lathe. And so I'm just out there shaving wood into chair parts with a draw knife, essentially, and, you know, a cobbled together bench. And then just taking my drill with a drill bit and trying to drill the angles by hand and stick the parts together. So really, I essentially built my first chair with a draw knife and a couple of spoke shaves, was, you know, in a drill on a drill bit. So nothing complex. And it was a post and rung chair. It wasn't a Windsor chair because I didn't have any tools to carve the seat. So I said, well, I'll do a post and rung chair, which forced me to learn how to do a rush pattern, you know, or an envelope pattern weave. I certainly didn't do a good one. It took me about 8 hours, I think, to weave that first seat. But, you know, there you go. I had a chair. And I was smitten with the process. It had me. And, you know, so I was pretty much consumed. It, of course, at that point, it was a hobby.
Right.
But that's any time I had time away from the shop, time away from my own business. That's what I did. And of course, I didn't have any children at that time. So I got to spend a lot of time in the shop as long as I wasn't taking my wife to dinner or, you know, watching a TV program or something in the evening. I was out there just trying to make chairs the best I could and learn everything I could. And learn, and then finally, you know, I get a lathe. I'm trying to turn those baluster turnings and, you know, and Pete Galbert. Had put a couple of YouTube videos up, and man, I studied those. I just watched them over and over and over and over again, and not realizing he was turning green maple, and I've got hard maple out there kiln dried, and can't figure out why I can't get these ribbon shavings to fly off, you know. But somehow I got them made. You know, I got the turnings made. I made some pieces, and that was really my stepping stone. Go ahead.
Well, hats off to you. I mean, being able to do that without taking a class. I mean, I got into making chairs, but I guess I made a couch. I made a Nakashima couch, so, you know, kind of one of his design couches. So that kind of got me interested in seating, and then I went and saw a lecture by Pete Galbert and said, I got to take a class from this guy. And then I took a class from Pete, and then the rest is history. I haven't made much flat furniture since.
All been
chairs, but you know, from that aspect, being able to you know, make a post and rung chair or whatever without even taking a class is just amazing.
Well, you know, my wife often laughs. She says, "You read a book and then you go, you do it." And you know, I don't know. I think, you know, I build the process in my mind. I see myself doing it, and I don't, you know, obviously what's in the head doesn't necessarily always relate to the real world, but, you know, I work a lot of that stuff out of my mind. I think I walk through the process so many times that generally when I get out in the shop, I don't know if I have more confidence, but I feel like there's a lot less hesitation. And, you know, frankly, I mean, it's just wood. I mean, what's the worst case? You drill it in the wrong spot, plug it, and then move on. And I generally never expect my first projects to really be anything. So I don't get too wrapped up in it. I always feel like the beginning of it, you're just getting an overview. You can't focus on the details until you can see the big picture. You know, maybe like the author, obviously, I don't know, probably reaching here, but you know, they have a storyboard, they have an outline.
Right.
And then they work in the details. And I think woodworking, any project is like that. Even ones that are otherwise quite complex, you know, you need to just start off with getting an overview of the process. And then once that's out of the way, you can see the details better and then you can focus on it. And I feel like that's when I invest more of myself in the project, when I really know where everything is going and I know those steps then I can focus on the details and try to make them more perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess it's maybe coming from the perspective that I had, hey, I took a class first and did this, but yeah, I think you're exactly right. When I go back to the couch I did, you know, I made a prototype and then I made the full scale version, but yeah, I went back and, you know, basically I just took pictures from auction sites and dimensions that I could get from the auction sites and be able to import those into SketchUp and kind of come up with something and go, all right, let me make a settee. And then if that works, I got all the angles worked and then I built the full size thing. But, you know, from that point on, I think the interesting thing for me in chairs is you really interact with the piece of furniture. You're sitting in it, you know, is it comfy? Is it not, you know, and you're moving around in it. And that's really what inspires me is, you know, not only the actual form of the chair, just looking at it, but actually saying, okay, is this actually comfortable? And, you know, what can you do to make it more comfortable? And what embellishments can you do to it? So, yeah, it's great. Yeah. Now you quickly became enamored with, as you said, Danish modern furniture and all of that. So now you've actually taught classes making a couple of chairs, I believe, as well as doing some of the cord weaving and that.
Yeah. I've done some teaching and, I've had a lot of requests for teaching my, and I actually enjoy doing it. I do. My most difficult thing is getting myself to schedule things far enough in advance and really really plan out my shop time.
Right.
And if I was stronger suited for that, I probably would do a lot more teaching. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I've taught a little bit of the I've taught the CH25.
Right.
Hans Wegner's CH25 lounge chair. A lot of interest in that cord, the weaving style, the flat weave or the plan flat weaving pattern that they do. And that's, you know, there's a few different patterns with the Danish cord. The envelope or the rush pattern is probably the most difficult one, even though it looks like the easiest one. But that flat weave pattern is truly the easiest one. And if you're a novice, that's where I suggest people to start with. You know, it looks more complicated, but it's one of the easier ones to achieve a nice look your first go, and it's faster. So, you know, I say incorporate those into your design if you're interested in working with this board.
Yeah, and don't you have some videos out there, or somebody has some videos out there of you doing it? I forgot what, if it was you or woodworking or something like that.
Well, back in the day, when I first started doing the Hans Wegner style chairs that have the envelope pattern seat or the rush pattern seat, whatever you want to call it, it was the time when YouTube was really, you know, kind of getting going. Right. And I was used to going, well, you can get on YouTube and learn anything, right? I mean, somebody's got a video that gives you an insight in there. And I really wasn't finding the books. They were out there, but whatever. I don't know. Maybe they weren't on Amazon or eBay or something at the time. So, but I figured out the pattern. And and I said, well, you know what? It's a little bit different with the Danish seat, the way they fill the corners in and so forth. Hey, if there's not a video out there, you know, I'll put something out to at least tell people the way I'm doing it. And maybe it'll help somebody. So, yeah, there's some I don't know. I think it was like 5 or 6 video, you know, series. That I put up on doing a Hans Wegner Danish cord seat. Yeah, I haven't done anything other than that.
Yeah, I always thought about, wouldn't it be interesting? I think Curtis Buchanan has a couple of contemporary chairs, and he has one that has kind of a woven back to it. Yeah, I forgot what to call that one, but I was going, wonder what that'd look like with Danish cord or something similar.
Yeah, I think he's using the hickory bark.
Yeah, he is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't have to be that design, but that kind of led me because, yeah, I've looked at the Danish cord and some of the stuff you've done and stuff and said, yeah, that'd be interesting to apply it into a Windsor form in some way, like as part of the back or something like that.
Well, you know, pretty much that Danish cord was a replacement for binder cane. So, like anything where cane was utilized, Yeah, it was more expensive, and you know, because obviously it's a natural material, and it's more time consuming. It takes about twice as long to do a binder cane seat. So the Danes they came up with like that flat weave design in particular was the one that was to replace binder cane in the chairs that they were producing. So you'll often find, particularly with Hans Wegner, you'll find designs that he originally designed with binder cane, and he would have a manufacturer, P.P. Mobler. They would make the very high-end piece, and then Carl Hansen and Son would make the more cost-friendly production version, and they would use Danish cord. And he would alter design just enough to be able to incorporate the Danish cord. And interestingly, you probably have more people that associate the Danish cord with the nice Danish designs as opposed to the versions that had the binder cane. Were less common. Yeah.
Right, right. Yeah, I remember, I think you gave a lecture on Danish modern at one of the fine woodworking, not fine woodworking, live at
Popular Woodworking.
Popular Woodworkings. Woodworking in America.
Woodworking in America, right. Yeah.
They all start running together now. But
don't they? Yeah.
But yeah, I remember attending that lecture, and it's fascinating. So I quickly ordered the One Good Chair book, and it's a great resource. It's fantastic.
Yeah, isn't it? Yeah. It's nice to find something that's actually in English.
Yes. And I encourage anyone that's interested in Danish furniture to get there. It's called Just One Good Chair by Wagner. And it's a great book. It's sometimes expensive, but if you just put it on Amazon, put it on a watch, sometimes it'll come down. I got a copy for like $35, which wasn't bad.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And what was even more nice is somewhere there must have been a mistake made, because they actually shipped me two of them.
Whoa.
And only charged me $35.
There you go.
So I gave the other one away to a friend who may be a co-host on this podcast.
I was just going to say. If it wasn't, I'd be like, wait a minute.
And for the curious ones, I'll have you narrow it down, and it wasn't me. Oh. So there you go.
That's right. That's right. Because I haven't seen you in 3 years or plus.
In fact, the guy we're talking about has a book of mine currently that he owes me.
So you really got into making the furniture. So what led you into, I guess you first started making planes and then got into more chair making tools.
Yeah. Yeah. The route there was really sort of unintentional. You know, you were talking about taking chair classes earlier, and I did eventually take a chair class with Pete Galbert. So Pete is sort of the reason that or has been a big influence in why I ended up going in some of the directions I've gone in. But when I couldn't get a class with Curtis, he told me, hey, check out Pete. And once I talked with Pete, I quickly realized I saw this the same guy doing the YouTube videos on turning, you know. So, got a class with Pete, got to know him a little bit. And after a little bit of time passed, we kept in contact. And I started doing a little bit of work with Curtis Buchanan as well. And
You did the drawings as chair plans for a while, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. And actually how that developed, just briefly, after I took a class with Pete, and I told him, I said, you know, I'm doing woodworking for a living now. And so I remember Pete, after a few days in a class, he just brought out all his plans and just dropped them on the bench and said, here, copy whatever you want to go back to Texas and make chairs. And so he saw my drawing, which I've always been into drawing. And I didn't realize this at the time, but after I got back home, he called me up about a week or so later and said, hey, Curtis is wanting to have some of his chairs drawn. Would you be interested in drawing them? I noticed, you know, you have a skill for that. And, in exchange, Curtis would do some classes with you. So I thought, why not? This sounds great. So that's kind of how I fell into that.
Wow.
And, started doing some. It was right when what's kind of cool about it is when Curtis was actually in the middle of shooting that first video series that really mm-hmm. launched him into the YouTube thing. And I don't know if he'd ever even posted any of the videos at that point. But his neighbor was coming over and shooting the videos.
Right.
And anyway, so, you know, I went out there and Curtis, we were trying to figure out, well, what chair am I going to draw? And I said, well, what chair are you building for the video? Well, I'm building this one. I said, well, why don't you just show me how to build that chair? Because it really doesn't matter to me. I just want to learn whatever you got to show me, you know? Mm-hmm. And so we'll build the chair together and I'll do the drawings. You know, I'll take all the notes and stuff. So I spent 2 weeks there with him and we just poured over this chair and took notes. And that's how I ended up drawing those chairs for him. But that's really not, you know, I'm not a professional. So, you know, working slow, it took us a long time. I think it took back and forth. And Curtis is one of these guys where he goes, well, I don't know what that angle is. I just put it up here like this and I drill it, you know. You got to love the guy, you know.
Yeah.
And he really is like old world when it comes to that, you know. So is it 11 degrees? Is it 14 degrees? I don't know. And so, you know, figuring that out, extracting that stuff from Curtis and going over his plans and talking to him and trying to memorize what his methods were, you know, we finally distilled that out. But I think those first plans took us like 13 months.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I started out drawing them by pencil and then we went to ink. And then I ended up having to teach myself how to do Adobe Illustrator. So we could get those things edited in a format. But where was I going with this? How did I get into tool making?
Yeah, we're going into plane making, I guess.
Making. Okay, so here's so fast. No,
this
forward.
Is all good stuff. Don't worry.
Okay.
Tangents are great.
So that's kind of how I got connected with, you know, these fellas that were not just doing woodworking, but they were kind of in the woodworking community, something I really didn't know about so much. But yeah, so fast forward a little time down the road, and Pete was doing some demos at Woodworking America. I think it was Woodworking America 2013. Mm-hmm. And so he says, hey, Caleb, you know, I could use some help in my booth. Would you want to come up to the event? And I said, well, okay, sure. What do you got in mind? He said, well, can you, you know, show my caliper off and do some turnings and things like that? And why don't you bring up those tools that you've been making? I know you've been thinking about seeing, you know, getting some feedback on them. Mm-hmm. And I had taught myself through one of the videos at Lee Nielsen how to make a side escapement plane. Strangely, not to make side escapement planes at all. I had been trying to make a specific hand plane for cutting a joint on Danish chairs. So I came up with this idea that I could do it a little bit simpler with a specific hand plane. And obviously, it needed to be something customized.
Right.
And the irony is I never ended up making that plane specific to the joinery. But I made a couple other planes, obviously some hollows and rounds. And I realized I liked it, and that you know, there was something kind of fascinating about getting these simple parts, you know, a side escapement plane, hollow and round or whatever. You got mm-hmm. three components. You got basically a chunk of wood, a wedge, and a chunk of steel. And right. Once you get those things tuned up just right, you know, you get these amazing shavings. And I was like, wow, I could not believe that something so primitive could work so well. Mm-hmm. And so what I would end up doing is, you know, here I'd make like, you know, 10 or 12 chairs for a client. And I was so tired of standing at the lathe for days and, you know, sanding for days and stuff that I would just take a day or two and I would just make some planes. Yeah. And it was almost like this kind of like recharge, you know, mm-hmm. to go back to my paid woodworking. So anyway, I kind of accumulated a fair amount of planes. I don't know, maybe I'd make 60, 70 or 80 planes at that point. And, Pete had said, you know, why don't you bring those planes, you know, some of those planes up here and just get some feedback. I know you're interested in what people think about them, you know, because one day this little light bulb went off in my head. I realized the guy who made the DVD for Lee Nielsen, Larry Williams, somehow I realized I'd heard stumble upon some information where he wasn't taking orders anymore and was backlogged, you know, 5, 6, 7 years or something. And I just thought to myself, I was like, wow, maybe people would want to buy these planes. I mean, they seem like they're working pretty good for me, you know? So that was sort of my goal. I kind of had this thought in the back of my mind, maybe somebody would be interested in these. And so I'm at Woodworking America, and Andrew, I don't remember his name, but he's one of the reps there for Lee Valley, brings up Fred West. And
Fred.
Yeah. And I didn't know who Fred was. And Fred's looking, he said, how much is that? And I said, I don't remember what it was, that's $2.15 or something. Oh, $2.15. I'll take a few of those. He was joking with me. And then before I knew it, he had bought close to $5,000 worth of tools off of me.
Oh my God.
Wow. And I think it was $4,700. And I was completely blown away. I couldn't believe this guy just was this, he's asking me what's the prices for them. And honestly, I didn't really know, except that I knew I had gotten pretty decent just making those planes, and I knew there was, here's kind of the rough area, the price it seems like these are going for. And I didn't expect anybody to buy any. You just, I'll take them. Boom. And Deneb from Lee Nielsen came along after, I think, second day or so, and says, hey, Caleb, Tom's, we're really kind of interested in what you're doing here. Would you want to come to our events? You don't have to pay anything. Just show up and you can demonstrate and, sell to our customers just like we're selling to them. I thought, well, that's it. This is an exceptionally kind and generous offer.
Right.
So, mm-hmm. Here I am with my head spinning, thinking, wow, I thought I was going to spend all my days making chairs, and maybe I need to give this some real serious thought. And so that's pretty much how it started. I went home and then started figuring out, well, how am I going to acquire the proper materials and keep, get them dry and acclimate and really like build up, because I knew I needed to kind of have a plan here.
Yeah.
And
so what were you making them out of at this time?
Well, at that point, when I first started making them,
before Southern Yellow Pine from
Well, I had made some out of walnut. I had made some out of hard maple. And I had, even at that point when I went to that show, I'm probably underplaying it. I felt, instinctively, I felt like this was something that I should invest something in. So I had, even when I was still in Houston, before I moved out here to Greenville, I talked to Curtis. I said, hey, Curtis, I can't find beach anywhere. Can't buy it anywhere. It's nowhere online. And it's hard to imagine because you get it now. But Curtis said, well, I can go to one of these sawmills and get a log, but you're in Texas. I said, well, hey, listen, even if I got to drive there, pick it up, I will. But I'm moving to Greenville, and so I'm only like 2 hours from you. We'll make it happen. Just get the log. I won't leave you hanging. And so that was the only way I could get a log, because I could not get anybody to even cut one. They almost thought like, yeah, right, who's going to – you're trying to tell them, I'll pay you white oak prices. And they're thinking, this guy is crazy. What? he's not going to show up. I tell them, I'll send you a check in the mail. And they'd almost hang up on me.
Right.
Who is this? I got a log from Curtis. And it's a funny story, because I drive up in my F-150. I had a 16-foot trailer. I get there, and this guy had a log that was 40 inches in diameter on one end, 36 inches on the other, and it was 19 feet long.
Oh, wow.
And I had no – this was a massive log. And, so he drops it on my trailer, and I got far enough away from that sawmill to call up Curtis and say, there's no way I'm getting 2 hours home, not through the mountains of Tennessee. So no. No. So, and if you've ever been to Curtis's place, he lives on a hill, pretty big slope. So I said, can I park this at your house? So he's got this one way single lane road going down behind a shop. I don't know what the incline is, but it's pretty steep. And I'm pulling down this hill, backing this log down into a little small flat spot. It was ridiculous. I don't know how we didn't go off the side of the hill, but anyway. Yeah, had to sit there for a few days, cut it up with a chainsaw, and, a week or two at my bandsaw, cutting it up into little billets and sticking into a homemade kiln and, drying the wood down. And at this point, I had nobody wanting to buy planes. I hadn't met Fred, but, I had a feeling there was something to this, and maybe it would end up being something. So yeah, that was a big hurdle to overcome. Yeah. Now I think there's a few guys online that you can buy billets from. So
yeah, it's a little bit more available now, but yeah, so you made planes. Are you ever going to go back to making planes?
You know, I never say never, you know, but I know generally my mindset is, it's, you know, as I said before, kind of an explorer. Yep. I find that I, sometimes when I kind of conquer a hill, you know, something, or I feel like,
always looking for the next challenge. Yeah.
Looking for the next challenge. And what I really, I think I sink, you know, I hone in more on something where I really feel like I can add to what's already there. Mm-hmm. Rather than just reproduce what's already been done. And there's some other guys out there making it too. So I also enjoy making a tool that's not accessible for people anywhere else. So that kind of drives me, you know.
Right.
If they can get it somewhere, you know, if Lee Valley is making a version of it, or Lee Nielsen, I sort of feel like there's not much motive for me to make maybe a more traditional version if the one they're making is good and it serves a purpose and it's at a good price, you know. I don't know. Maybe I'm looking to add a little value there, though obviously my tools aren't, big production Lee Valley prices, and I definitely recognize that.
Well, what I think is interesting is, you know, for listeners that are interested in making wooden planes, is you have plans available on your old blog still.
Yeah.
For some of the planes that you made. Yeah.
You know, and if there is one thing that I would like to do, and who knows when I'll get to this, but I think about it, it's a pretty regular, is I really would like to compile all the plans that I put together in a single resource. And if I could do it in such a way where I could give it away, I would. I love to get, you know, I try to, if I can, I could give it away. But you know what? I would feel really good if I could even dedicate some time, put those into even, you know, a book of some sort that has the plans. Because, I spent a lot of effort putting that information together. And it's not really anywhere else that's easily available, with the exception of buying antique ones in multiples and comparing the differences and trying to boil it down into standard sizes and so forth, you know. But that's not usually something most people have time for.
Yeah, that would be fantastic. I haven't seen, who's the other plane maker that just came out with a book? Chris Schwartz, Lost Art Press did.
David Fink.
Yes.
So that's a reprint of I think maybe they've added some things in there or something, but that's a book from, I don't know, was that the late 90s?
No, there was somebody else that did something. Anyway, you've now gone into tool making. So you went from the planes into making some more chair maker tools and the spoke shaves. And am I missing something in between the planes and going into more chair making tools?
So how that worked out was, the chairs I made for sale were primarily Danish stuff and mostly post and rung chairs. So I really wasn't making Windsor chairs. I made a number of Windsor chairs, but I was not really making Windsor chairs for sale. Most of my clients wanted Danish stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But that said, Pete Galbert was encouraging me to try to do some teaching in my shop. And even at one point he was kind of thinking about maybe moving down to the Asheville area. And so we were talking about doing some classes, and I said, well, hey, Pete, I got this big shop. And he says, well, hey, you know what? I'm going to come down and let's have a class in your shop. I'll teach a chair class, kind of get things rolling so you can see, you know, and get comfortable with it, you know? And I said, okay, that sounds fun to me. No matter what, I want to hang out with you for a week and let's make some chairs. And so when he was here, you know, I wasn't making a chair. I'm just, you know, kind of being the helper with the chairs and stuff. And I'm looking through his tools, some of his spoke shaves. And I said to Pete, I said, hey, what's your favorite spoke shave here? And he pulled out this boxwood, traditional style spoke shave, hands it to me. He says, man, I love this shave. He says, if people could get this shave, you know, I've always have students in my class And, you know, one of the biggest problems is, you know, they use these tools and then they go away. They can't buy them anywhere. They can't find them anywhere. Mm-hmm. And, you know, depending where you are in the country, you know, this being down in Texas,
right?
You don't just go to the neighborhood yard sale and find antique tools. No, you don't. And because you know, when you're up in the Northeast, you know, Pete's just like, well, just, you know, go to the flea market. They're everywhere. And I'm like, Pete, they are not everywhere in Houston, Texas. And and that's a large part of the country is like that. So anyhow.
Yeah. If you found a ragged ass molding plane at some antique store, you're almost obligated to buy it here in Houston, even though it's not going to work.
You know, getting off track here a little bit, but I had a guy that lived near me and Katie, an acquaintance, and he knew a fellow that was selling an old toolbox. He says, you got to get Caleb over there. And that was the only time I ever came across some old molding planes. And I bought every one of them. and unbeknownst to me, those planes were actually in really excellent shape.
Oh, that's nice.
For compared to what I found over the years. I had no clue that they were in that good a shape until I compared them. But anyhow, so Pete's, you know, showing me the spoke shave, and I said, you know who should be making this spoke shave? Should be Claire. If you guys know Claire Minahan, mm-hmm. she makes that really beautiful travisher.
Yeah.
And I said, Claire really should be.
I have both of hers, so just like.
Yeah. I've got one of hers too. You know, I got a beautiful rosewood one that I bought from her. First time I picked it up back there. I met her at WI 2013, I think it was, and. Took one of those home. Yeah. But anyhow, I said, you know, Claire really should be making this spoke shape. So, I went over and I sat down on my computer and I just started analyzing the spoke shape. And then the gear started turning and I started seeing how they were producing this. It kind of clicked into place. I could see the processes and, mm-hmm. you know, how they were shaping it and stuff. And because, you know, they weren't making these things by hand, right? They were machining them. And the blades were being stamped out. I think drop forged is how they were made. But you know, I just sort of kind of reanalyzed the tool, and I drew up some plans, and I tweaked them for about a week or so, on and off. And I said, hey Claire, here you go. You need to make this spoke shape. And you know, it just didn't really suit the setup she had, her processes in her shop and stuff. And I said, heck, you know what? I'm gonna make 100 of these spoke shaves. I'll probably go broke doing it, and I'm just gonna give it a try, and sent off the design for a blade that I came up with to a machinist and stuff, you know, and then just dove in head first and just said, well, I'm gonna try to make this work, and it turned out it worked, and it's again, it's like one of those tools where I really didn't see it being a tool that would, grab my attention as much as it did and take me away from making the side escapement planes. Honestly, I thought I was going to probably do only that from here on out. But the more I started developing with the spoke shaves, I mean, I have a shelf full of different spoke shave designs that just keeps stacking up because I just keep trying different things with it. And, or I find an antique shape. How did this work? Why did they make it this way? Why did they make it different than another manufacturer? And there's just a lot to explore there. And I think I like the fact that it's about carving. You know, I like car. You know, it's not flat and perfectly straight. So that's kind of easy to achieve once you understand that process of getting flat. How do I get flat? But when you throw a curve in there, what makes the mind really kind of work? And then what you think is going to work doesn't always work. So what's the ergonomics of the placement of the hand? Where does it need to be in position with the cutting blade? What angle do you want the cutting blade at? Mm-hmm. There's all these little things, and you get to kind of explore and figure out, like, wow, there's the sweet spot. And that's kind of exciting. And then when you get there, and I do get a real kick out of putting a tool, especially a wooden tool that looks so primitive, into somebody's hands, especially somebody who is a woodworker and knows tools.
Right.
And then they give it a try, and they're like, the little light in their eyes sort of flicker, like, wow,
mm-hmm.
that's cool. There's something different about that, you know, and that little bit of excitement. It's sort of like you get to kind of share that shop excitement of woodworking. Maybe only woodworkers get it, but Yeah, I sometimes when people ask me what I do for a living, you know, I'll jokingly say I'm a therapist, and and because in some ways, you know, that's I think I got into woodworking because, you know, I had a business with a number of employees and, you know, in the stressful, you know, economy and stuff like that at the time. And I would go out in the shop and just make shavings and forget it all. And right. and I think most people who are buying my tools, a big portion of them, they do it just for that. You know, some guys buy a Harley and they drive it, and that's, you know, they got their money in that and they really enjoy it. It's their quiet time, their downtime. But you got guys that'll, you know, buy and collect my tools because that's their therapy. That's the way they wind down from their job that, you know, that pays the bills day in and day out, sends their kids to college and so forth. Yeah. So, Well, I like playing that little part.
Yeah, I remember when I came across your spokeshave because I had quite a little collection myself. And then I was at a class and there was a gentleman there that had your spokeshave. I go, well, you mind if I try that out? And he said, no, go ahead. So I tried it out and went, yeah, I got to buy one of these. And then right after, I'm sitting there waiting. All right, when's the next order? When's the next cycle that you're doing? And then it's like, and they now he has a round shave out. And I'm going, well, damn it, I got to buy both now.
Well, I don't, you know, there's one fella, I don't know his name, you know, and I have the best, I have the best clients. I'm telling you, you couldn't tear me away from this job, even if I got so sick of making spokeshaves or making planes or whatever, because, you know, I've had my, you know, previous businesses and stuff, you know, boy, I know how it is to have clients that aren't always the most happy people. It's just the situation they're in, but I love the woodworking clients. I don't know what it is. I think it's just the right dynamics. I've got this one fellow that I don't know. He must have like an RSS feed on my website because as soon as I update it and there's a different wood, you know, there he goes. He'll buy it. I'm just always amazed. You know, it's like this guy's the most loyal, dedicated collector of my tools. I'm fascinated, you know, and honored and humbled that you know people want to buy the things that you make. You know, it's hard to get a much better job than that, you know.
Like I said, I just kind of ventured into making jigs, I guess, not really tools, but at least something for folks. So I can really appreciate the work that goes into it because I thought I knew until you actually do it. And I mean, I only had like 11 orders, but even so, it was like, holy crap, you know, everything that you thought took like, oh, well, it only takes about a couple of minutes to do that. Well, by the time you multiply it over 11 times, you're talking about half the day just doing this one operation.
Process refinement. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, I did a lot of that. In my whole little production run I did, I didn't cut myself, didn't nick myself until I got to packing. It's like Band-Aids all over the place. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Which I thought was just hilarious. I was just laughing. I'm going, I'm getting paper cuts. I'm cutting myself on the tape dispenser. It's just like,
Just don't get any blood on the item that you're packing. Right?
Exactly. Right. Exactly. Yeah. That's why I had to get the Band-Aid. Yeah. Make sure.
Yeah.
It's your own personal, maker's mark.
Yeah, exactly. Could be.
Yeah.
So now I know you're also working on a little monster shave. Is that correct?
Yeah.
To close out the spoke shaves.
Yeah, really what I would like to do, you know, I was just having a conversation with a chair maker and I said, you know, I'd really be able to, cause you know, if I wanted to work the system, I'd make about 10 different sizes of spoke shaves and I probably could sell them one size of every, but no, I mean, I think what would I want in my toolbox? You know, I like a big shave, like the monster shave. I want a nice standard shave all around my standard, you know, traditional shave and then one for the nice tight curves, the round shave. So the thing with the monster shave that I've made in the past is I love the size of it, but I also love pairing my spoke shaves with exotic woods. Not so much because they're just exotic. I mean, obviously that makes it interesting and fun. You know, we love exotic woods. But I love the density and I love the feedback that that gives. But when you start making that big of a spoke shave out of a piece of ebony or boxwood or something, not only is it more difficult to find, and it's also much more expensive. But I think as I described it, it feels like maybe a little bit of an overindulgence when I feel like maybe I could make this tool achieve the same, you know, it functions in the same way, but maybe it's a bit more compact. And so in my mind, there's that next challenge. Can I make this tool really be able to have the same aggressive cutting, you know, action that I want out of this tool? I can really just go at it and carve, and you know, sort of that step between the draw knife and my regular shave, something in there where I can kind of attack it, but I got a little bit more guidance in there to shaping. And so that's where I want to call. That's where I want to go. And I think when I was talking to this fellow about it, you know, I said, yeah, you know, I got to get this little monster together. And it just sort of clicked. Yeah. I said, well, there it is. It's a little version of the monster shave. So, yeah, right.
Pre-orders are October 31st, right?
Yeah. You know, well, you know, I'm as soon as I said that I was making this, making a Travisher, you know, come next spring, boy, I got a little bit inundated with people saying, but wait, okay, when are you making the standard shave again? When are you making the monster shave? And and I realized I probably need to make at least some more of my standard shave,
right?
And then get this little monster together. There's definitely, I think I've been holding people on that leash a little bit too long, you know. Hey, I'm gonna, you know, we're hanging that carrot out in front of them. How do you want to say it? Hey, I'm gonna do the monster shave again. And you know, I want to try to live up to that. And now that I have sort of this little extra challenge there, I've got a lot of motivation and a lot of desire to jump in there. And like I said, I like making something I know people are going to use and they want to use. So I say, why not? And you know, the Travisher can wait. I've been working on that thing for like 3 years or more. And Claire's got a beautiful one. If you want a Travisher in the meantime, there's nobody better, you know. And that was one of my goals. I said, Claire, if I'm going to make a Travisher, it's got to be at least as good as what you're doing, and add something that hers doesn't, you know. You know, it's hard to beat such a good design, and that's obviously not my goal. I'm very good friends with Claire, and no competition there. But you know, it would be something different, you know. So if I'm going to do something, I want to at least offer something different. Yeah. And
right. Well, I saw your Travisher. It does look very interesting. And I think I gave you a little hard time on Instagram. It's like, yep, you know, you're digging into my wallet once again. but it looks like you're going to have some sort of a depth adjustment on that, or at least some sort of blade adjustment. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the direction that I'm taking my spoke shaves in, with the bevel down, you know, more akin to what you see with, like, you know, your Japanese style spoke shaves. There's some positives and there's some drawbacks there with a Travisher design, and that, you know, you got a curved edge now that you're gonna have to maintain that shape to you know, sort of like a round. You know, a hollow or a round, you know, now you gotta maintain that shape. So that's probably the biggest obstacle I see with some people who maybe don't feel comfortable with that. So that could be a challenge in comparison to the Travishers that have a bent flat blade bevel up. But what I like about it is it maintains the mouth opening. The position of the cutting edge in relation to the toe of the tool maintains the same location throughout the life of the blade and the life of the tool. And
that makes sense. Yeah.
So that's been my motive there with utilizing those blade styles. Plus, now you can, as the blade wears, you know, you have more blade to advance. So, which in another way extends the life, the usefulness of the tool. You know, and that's been some of the drawbacks, taking a straight traditional spoke shave design that was almost, I don't know if they considered it a throwaway tool, but considering that it was just a wooden sole, the way the blades were stamped out, I think the thinking was this tool has a relatively short lifespan.
Right.
But my tools, I've never wanted to produce something that had a short lifespan, you know?
Yeah.
Right, you know? And neither do the people who buy it. They don't want it.
Oh,
yeah.
Of course not.
Right. And so, that's why I've really been moving in that direction. Because the other way, you know, when you have the bevel up and the flat side, the broader portion of the blade down, if I'm saying that correctly, you know, that as you sharpen that blade, it continues to move backwards further and further away from the toe of the tool, which changes the way that it operates and that it feels. And so you might be tempted to want to get a replacement blade sooner or something along those lines, you know.
Now, who are you using for your blades? I noticed, you know, on the Travis shirts, that definitely bent. So are you contracting that out? Or are you doing that yourself? Or
so what I do is usually, for sure, when I'm prototyping a tool, you know, I'm making all the blades slow weight, you know, shaping them out and grinding and stuff. But when it comes to production, I will try to pair up with, in the past, I've used machine shops. Now I'm using, I had a nice machinist guy, retired guy, but he's in it. He does a lot of brass steam engine parts and all this sort of stuff. And finally, one day he says, Caleb, I just can't fit in all this O1 tool steel with everything I'm doing. And I said, you know what? I get it. I understand. I'll find another resource. Can you please hold on for a little bit while we're working? Sure, sure. And it sort of synced up with some of the new blade designs that fit perfectly with water jet cutting. So now I water jet cut, and I actually do all the heat treating in-house still. I've sent them out before, but I've developed a method that works so well, and I don't have to wait about, you know, for the lead time, you know, getting there, getting back, and
right.
And those heat treating shops can vary in quality sometimes to an extreme degree. Sometimes, you know, the distortion that comes from the blades is sometimes surprising. So, I've kept that in house because I can control it, the timing, and I get really good results. If I was doing something like A2 or I'd like to do some PMV11, those will definitely get sent out to a heat treater because of the special requirements for heat treating those steels. But yeah, I mean, I do all the flattening and shop on occasion. I have a buddy that's about 20 minutes from me. I'll go over and do some surface grinding on a surface grinder. But otherwise, pretty much everything's done in shop the slow hand grinding way. I would definitely send that out to a shop if I could find somebody that would 100% do it to the degree that I want it done. You know, let somebody who has that specialty really
right.
put that to use, and then I could focus on the woodworking part of it. But I've yet to really find that. So I most of the time I'm doing it all myself.
Well, yeah. Fantastic. Well, tell us, do you have any other projects or tools in the pipeline that you want to share with us?
Project? Well, like personal projects or yeah.
Sure, anything. Yeah.
Well, making my wife a nice Danish modern dresser. She's been asking for like 6 years. I posted some of the dovetail corners I'm doing right now. Probably look like I was building a credenza or just a big box or something at this point.
Yeah.
But it's eventually supposed to be a dresser. That's a little personal project, but or more a commission from my wife. which I do enjoy. You know, it's when we do that, I end up going, well, you know what, if you want me to make it, it's going to have a little bit of my own designs in there. So that's how we get away with that. Actually I've got a archtop guitar that I'm wanting to build. I've gotten more into doing some luthery stuff.
Cool.
So the Gibson L5 archtop guitar.
Nice.
Oh,
yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I've got some wood that's been setting aside. I've had a top glued up for quite some time, and just got to find a little bit of time. Basically, I got to finish this dresser, and then when I get that done, I'll be able to kind of launch into that. Come February.
Yeah, now I assume you play guitar? Or?
Yeah. I've played guitar since I was in my teens.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, so that's something I enjoy doing. And last year or so, I've been spending a lot more time with it. And if anybody who, you know, follows my Instagram feed, they know back in the spring, made a archtop, an A5 style Gibson mandolin. And we had a fella, actually I met at WIA, I don't know if it was 15 or 14, one of those in there, Austin Papp, as a guitar maker. Anyway, we had him. He came to the shop, and a couple of fellows I know, Jeremy Wright, we were talking about him earlier, Ann Braggs of Ann Briggs, rather, of Ann of All Trades. So we just, you know, just kind of got together. I know she's played mandolin, and when I knew that, said, hey, come on, you'll probably enjoy this. So yeah, we made that, and yeah, it's just, you know, it's another one of those little, I guess, you know, somebody would call it a rabbit hole to kind of go down.
Well, it seems
explore.
Like a bunch. I mean, maybe it's all the people I follow, but it seems like a bunch of people are jumping down that rabbit hole. A lot of mandolins and ukuleles being built going on.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you play an instrument and you're a woodworker.
You're going to get there.
That's what I think it is, you know. And, you know, Austin jokes with me. He's like, you're going to become a guitar maker, because I'm always hitting him. What's this little fact, you know, fun fact or whatever that I need to know on business? And I said, no, I already know what it is to lose money, you know, in woodworking. I mean, those guys, you know, they make the most beautiful instruments, but it's so hard to compete. I mean, they should, you know, most of these acoustic guitar guys, they should be making like 30 grand for that guitar by the time they're done with all the work they put into it. They're just fantastic in the thought and the tuning of every component. But, you know, a lot of those guys, you know, they're trying to sell it for $8,000 or $9,000, and then they're taking a cut from a shop they put it in. And boy, they, you know, they're doing it for the love of it, you know. So I'm trying to do it for the fun of it, you know, when it comes to that part of it. But yeah, it's fun. We're actually February, Ann and Austin and Jeremy and Greg Pennington and myself, we're going to build a OM style flat top acoustic guitar. So that's our winter luthiers camp, I think is what we're calling it. You know, I'll be scratching that itch pretty well this year, I think.
Yeah, well, that's great. Yeah, I've met most of those folks. I have not met Greg, though, yet, and I need to do that. Seems like a great guy.
Greg, you know, he's wonderful.
He has converted me over to the lasers for reaming, though.
Yeah. everybody gives him flack about that, but yeah.
No, once you try it, I don't know. I guess it's maybe if you've done without it, and I don't know if you quite have the muscle memory if you start by using lasers, but if you...
You know what? I think everybody who has made fun of him or given him a hard time, because it's all the guys that know him, and if you know Greg, you love Greg, but I think everybody who's given him a hard time has at one point or another eventually said, you know what? I'm going to do that laser thing Greg does for this one thing, and then you visit their shop and they got it over in the corner, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Once you use it, you can't... You're thinking... Why in the world am I not going to use it? It's right there.
It's right
you know?
Exactly. But because you just autocorrect as you're turning, and it's just like boom, 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 done.
Yep.
You know? It's amazing.
Yeah.
But anyway, I tried it for drilling, but it wasn't the best for drilling. It was too hard to line up. But for reaming, oh, man.
Yeah.
It's a game changer.
Yeah.
Well, with that, let's get on to our fortnightly beer choices. So, Caleb, do you have anything to recommend?
Well, I am extremely gluten intolerant, I don't drink any beer. Unfortunately, it's been that way for about 10 or 11 years. But I tell you, my wife loves the Hazy Little Thing by Sierra Nevada.
Oh yes,
it's an IPA. So that's one that she really likes. I'm a wine guy, you know.
Okay.
Trader Joe's.
Trader Joe's.
Yeah.
Three buck chuck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They have one. Oh man, I was supposed to get the name of it. It's a Cote de Rhone. It's the area that it comes from. I think it's like $6 or $7, but I think that's a great little red wine they have over there.
Yeah. Well, fantastic. So, Sean, what do you have?
So I went into my local beer store today on the way home, and I picked up Dogfish Head's new, Suddenly Comfy, which is an Imperial cream ale, which is good. I mean, I think it's among their 2019 offerings. I don't believe they've ever had it out before. It's quite nice. It's kind of malty and roasty and warming, and it's good. It's October finally.
Exactly. Speaking of October, I am actually drinking an Oktoberfest from St. Arnold Brewing, which is a brewing company here in the Houston area. Caleb might remember.
Yep.
Been around for a little while, but their Oktoberfest is out, and it's a great beer. It's a little malty, a little hoppy, and very smooth. So nice. Highly recommend that. So Caleb, so where can folks find you on the interwebs?
Yeah, they can find me on my website, which is just my name, Caleb James, and then Maker, CalebJamesMaker.com. Mm-hmm. Of course, on Instagram, Caleb James Maker, same username there. And that's pretty much where I hang out. IG is usually, Instagram is usually where I'm posting most updates and things that are going on. I've got an old blog somewhere floating around there, one of those old Blogspot blogs, but I don't update that. I guess that's kind of not something most of us do anymore, but you know, a few hanging on. It might find its resurgence, kind of is a little bit,
yeah,
I guess.
Yeah. Well, there's some good content out there. Absolutely, some of your old blog posts where you go into some of the things you're doing. So, and like I said, you got some plans out there, and it's fantastic.
Yeah, on my website, you can if you scroll down to the bottom, you can get to my old blog, and even on my website, I have a little section with free plans. So some of them include some articles that I wrote for Popwood with the plans in there, and then some free some of the plans for making planes are in there as well. Yeah.
Excellent. So Sean, where can folks find you?
Per usual, you can find me as at SeanW78 on most social medias, including Instagram, and Untappd, and that's about it. How about you, Kyle?
You can always find me at Barton.Kyle on Instagram, the only social media platform that matters. And with that just about wraps it up for this show. So if you haven't already, please subscribe to the show on iTunes or Google Play Music, or just search for the Modern Woodworkers Association on your favorite podcatcher, and then you'll never miss any of our exciting episodes. And while you're there, please leave us a review.
And thank you, as always, for listening to the Modern Woodworkers Association podcast. If you like the show, please visit us at the Modern Woodworkers Association.com. You can follow the MWA on Twitter at MWA_national, or on Instagram at MWA_podcast, or like the MWA on Facebook if we ever post there. The best thing you can do is tell a friend. Word of mouth goes a long way in sharing our discussion.